We now have a new challenge, perhaps the most monumental in recorded history. The opportunity to investigate a phenomenon that could change our destiny. A look at ourselves 1,000 years in the future.
We're going to examine and perhaps question some widely held theories of what may have happened to this Earth of ours. We're going to investigate some strange and bizarre events in the present, unbelievable happenings as fresh as today's headlines. And more important, perhaps, we're going to take a searching and scientific look into the future. We're reaching more and more out into space. Perhaps, as we may learn, someone, something, somewhere in space is reaching out to us.
Who the visitors are, where they're from, and what they want is unknown.
Bigfoot was attracting national attention and was now rapidly becoming the most intriguing mystery on the North American continent. Scientists and photography experts have examined the individual frames of this film and have come to the conclusion that the film and the creature are authentic.
Telepathy, psychokinesis, Bigfoot and black masses, UFOs and Atlantis, Kirlian photography, cloning, and cryonics. These subjects all have one thing indisputably in common. People want to know more about them. For mankind's future on Earth and beyond.
Welcome to After Dark Radio with your host, Brian Alvarez.
How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez here on After Dark Radio. It is our Sunday night debut here on June 21st, After Dark Radio. Here on the Dark Matter Radio Network, moving from Fridays to Sundays. We'll be here every single Sunday night. Hopefully you enjoy the show tonight. We got a lot of great things for you. And just in case we got any new listeners tonight, I'm going to go over a couple of things here. And then we're going to get right into the meat of the show, which tonight is going to be an interview with Joshua Cutchin, who is the author of A Trojan Feast, which you can find on Amazon.com. It's been out for a while. The book, A Trojan Feast, The Food and Drink Offerings of Aliens, Fairies, and Sasquatch, which came out in May, and I purchased the book. And I'm sure he is sick and tired of hearing people give these goofy puns, but I devoured it. And it was an excellent book. We're going to have him on the show here tonight. For those of you that have been listening for a while, you're well aware of what he's going to be talking about, and if the title of the book didn't make it clear. For those of you that have ever read Jacques Vallée, you know the comparisons that he has drawn for years now between the UFO phenomenon, abductions, aliens, and the fairy lore that we have read about and we have had stories handed down for generations. Tie-ins, there are many of them. Alien abductions, people report running into small men, little fellas, big heads. And of course, if you've ever read fairy lore, little people, sometimes big heads. They take you away, you go somewhere, it feels like you've been there for hours. When you return, much time has passed. In some stories, such as that of Rip Van Winkle, it's days, years, centuries have passed. Essentially, it's relativity being told in tales that were written long before the theory of relativity was made famous by Albert Einstein, in the last century, in fact. So I'm sure everybody has heard these tie-ins, but what Joshua Cutchin has done is he has zeroed in on what is called the food taboo. What is that? Well, many of you, if you've actually ever seen the movie Pan's Labyrinth, would actually be a modern-day representation of this, but the stories go that if you ever are paid a visit by a fairy, a little person, and you are taken away, the one thing you must never do when you're there is eat the food. Because if you eat the food, you will never be able to return. And he's zeroing in on this because not so much the same sort of stories in UFO lore, but often there is an exchange of food or something resembling food. For example, some people who are abducted by aliens report that they're given some sort of pill, sometimes at the very beginning, sometimes before they return. Sometimes they're told, if you eat this, you'll have no memory of what occurred. And of course, later under hypnosis, they recall all of these events. But there are tie-ins. The giving and taking of food between the stories of fairies and the stories of those abducted by aliens. On top of that, as noted in the title of the book, there are tie-ins to folks who report meetings with Sasquatch or other hairy hominids. In lore, modern-day accounts from hundreds of years ago, the giving and taking of food. He's found tie-ins between all three of these things. And granted, the tie-in with Sasquatch, admittedly, Joshua Cutchin notes, is tenuous. But it is interesting that even in these reports of what most, in fact, I would say that virtually every serious Bigfoot researcher believes that Sasquatch is some sort of flesh and blood creature. It is an animal of some sort. However, it is interesting that in these supposed mythical stories of fairies, and in these supposed stories of alien abductions, in all three of these different things, including stories of Sasquatch abductions, food plays a part. And so Joshua Cutchin is going to be our guest later on in the program tonight. The book is awesome. I'm just telling you that right now. I'm not making any money off this, obviously, unless you happen to buy from our Amazon link at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. But I read the book cover to cover. I loved the book. And it was funny because I was on a Jacques Vallée kick. And I'm trying to remember the website that I was on. I'll actually feel bad if I don't give them credit. I've got a link here on my phone, so I'm going to find out what it is. Mysterious Universe. The Mysterious Universe website had a review of A Trojan Feast, and I think I saw the link perhaps first on anomalist.com, but I went and I read the review, and the thing was on my Kindle within about 5 minutes, and I read it. And since we were making the big move here to Sunday nights, I thought, what better guest to get on the show than Joshua Cutchin? And I found his email, sent him a message, and lo and behold, he is going to be the guest on the program tonight. And so I am very happy about that. For those of you that might be listening for the first time, just a quick overview of myself. I've been doing After Dark Radio for probably about 4 years now. I've actually been doing radio since 1999. I was part of IATA.com, which was a internet radio station that was before its time. There was a lot of money behind it. They had studios in Times Square. They were broadcasting solely over the internet. And unfortunately, there was not a lot of money to be made with internet radio in 1999. And so essentially what happened is IATA went off the business, out of business. And the show that we had on IATA, it was called Wrestling Observer Live. Covered pro wrestling and mixed martial arts, which is my main job. And we were picked up by Sports Byline USA, which is in San Francisco, California. And we have been a staple of Sports Byline USA ever since. And to this day, I've got 21 hours of programming weekly on Sports Byline USA. We go Monday through Friday at noon. And we also have a Sunday show at 3 Pacific, 6 Eastern. So I do a lot of audio. And I also do a website where we cover pro wrestling and mixed martial arts. And I have been a fan of paranormal radio as long as I can remember. The early 90s when I first heard Art Bell. I loved Dreamland. I loved Art Bell's Coast to Coast AM. And when I had the opportunity to do my own paranormal podcast, I thought I may as well try it. I'll give it a shot. Long story short, all of the subscribers that we have to our website that love wrestling, professional wrestling, they also happen to love After Dark Radio, and so it has grown ever since. Very happy to be a part of the Dark Matter Radio Network, and I'm very, very happy today to be joining the Sunday lineup. When I was a kid, I didn't have time to listen every single day, but I always had time on the weekends, and so I loved listening to Dreamland with Art Bell. And now I get to do my own version of Dreamland here on Sunday nights with After Dark Radio. And yes, a lot of this show, I'm certainly no Art Bell, but there are tributes to Art Bell all over this program. There always have been, and there always will be, unless the day comes where Art says, okay, enough of these tributes, we've got to knock this stuff off. But for now, yes, After Dark Radio, the old After Dark newsletter that Art Bell produced, that is the name we have used for this radio show. And we do have four lines here, some of which may sound familiar to you, all homages to Art Bell. We're going to be taking phone calls later on in the program. But if you need the phone numbers, you can go to afterdarkradioshow.com. I'm going to throw the numbers out here and maybe one other time during the show. But since there's four of them, the easiest thing you can do is run up and grab them here off of the website. The phone numbers, if you are west of the Rockies, 425-488-0525 is the number. If you are east of the Rockies, 425-482-1686. We have a Parts Unknown line, a Wrestling Observer reference. Parts Unknown means you can call from anywhere in the universe. Doesn't matter if you're west, east of the Rockies, international, it doesn't matter where you're at. 425-398-7353. And we do have a first-time caller line. If you have never called this program before, the number is 425-398-7289. We'll be taking phone calls here in a few minutes. If you'd like to email me, brian@afterdarkradioshow.com. My Twitter handle, @BrianAlvarez. And the Facebook page is facebook.com/afterdarkradioshow. And by the way, if you head up there, last week's show is available as a free download. If you did not hear the June 12th show, my 40th birthday show, by the way, featuring Tim Swartz of Conspiracy Journal, the show is up there right now as a free MP3 download. So I recommend you go up there and grab that, listen to it later on. And when this show ends, this show is going to go up there on the After Dark website, and that show with Tim Swartz will be gone. So now is your chance to grab it. If you're listening live, jump up there and get it, and prepare for this show here live. As noted, artbell.com is the place to go for more information on the Dark Matter Radio Network. For those of you that have been following the story of the return to Art Bell, or of Art Bell, to the Dark Matter Radio Network, a couple of quick notes. First off, the subscription area is now available. If you would like to subscribe, if you'd like to become a time traveler and get access to all of Art's shows, the place to go is darkmatterdigitalnetwork.com. You can sign up. It's $5 a month. Since there appear to be a lot of questions that I've seen online about this, the deal is Art's new show is going to be free if you listen live. And the live time slot will be the same as this one, just Monday through Friday, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern, hence midnight in the desert. And you can listen free over the TuneIn Radio app or through the Dark Matter Digital Network, or probably about 20 over-the-air affiliates right now, all of which are available if you head up to artbell.com. You'll be able to listen to Art's show absolutely free. However, if you want the podcast library, if you want access to the wormhole, the only way to get access to that is to subscribe. It is $5 per month. The membership area opened up, I believe, on Friday night, if I recall correctly. Even though I work here, I did sign up because I really want to support this. I wish I could say that I was the first ever subscriber, but one guy got in before me, so I was the second subscriber. And since that time, they have signed up hundreds and hundreds of people. And as Art has noted on a number of places, Bell Gab, Facebook, etc., the only way that this is going to be able to work out is if all of the costs can be covered. There are going to be costs associated with all sorts of different things, including the music licensing. So if you love the idea of Art Bell returning, $5 to subscribe monthly, or there is a donation button there, and you can support the return of Art and the Dark Matter Digital Network. If you've been listening over the last couple of months, the audio quality has improved dramatically. They've done a lot of upgrades. And in fact, tonight, there was supposed to be an audio upgrade to the quality of this show. But literally, I can't say the last minute, literally in the last 3 minutes, something went wrong. And we haven't quite figured out what it is yet, but next week we're going to get this thing working, and the audio quality of this show will increase as well. So for the time being, we're going to continue on. Should still sound great, but I am a stickler for audio quality, and so my main desire is for it to sound the best. And so we are going to figure that out. Before we start going to the phones, I've got some news I want to talk about here today. Normally we start out with the news, we go to the guest, we take phone calls and such. And I wanted to read this here. This is from the Hawaii Tribune Herald. And it's interesting because it ties into, in a way, what we're going to be talking about tonight with Joshua Cutchin. He, of course, is the author of A Trojan Feast, The Food and Drink Offerings of Aliens, Fairies, and Sasquatch. This story here, this is by Colin Stewart of the Hawaii Tribune Herald. Neurologist Michael B. Russo says that he initially didn't know what to make of the first few patients who told him they had been abducted by aliens from outer space. He said their doctor sent them to me because they had headache pain or some sort of neurological problem. Their primary physicians didn't know they were having the problem due to abduction, but I would find out as part of my interview. When I'd ask how long they have had the problem and when they first noticed it, then they would tell me. As part of his regular testing of patients, Russo used a $200,000 dense array electroencephalography, a DEEG machine, the only one of its kind in all of Hawaii, to map the electrical activity in the brains of his patients. New patients, including several from the Big Island, came in with similar complaints about being abducted, leaving Russo to wonder if there was anything the patients shared in common when it came to brain wave activity. The patients, he said, were just coming to me. I started noticing patterns across the patients. I'll see three or four patients with something that's similar, and then I will try to find an explanation for what I am seeing. Each one of the patients claims to have been abducted by aliens and believe that a transmitter was implanted in their brain, and all of them showed abnormalities in brain wave activity in their parietal globe, I believe it's called. He says that's the area that does visual and auditory integration into higher order thinking. This area processes visual and auditory data, but they can intrinsically create it themselves and then send it to the prefrontal region where they become aware of it. Our thinking is that there's something in the parietal areas that's generating the feeling that transmissions from aliens are being sent to their brain. So essentially, all of these people are experiencing the same thing. They believe they've been abducted. They believe that the aliens have put a transmitter in their brain. And when this doctor, Dr. Russo here, uses his $200,000 machine to map their brain, he finds similar activity in every single one of their brains. Now, obviously, there's a lot of different ways you can look at this. Some people would argue that, well, maybe all of the men or women did get abducted, and whatever the aliens did affected their brains, and thus that's why all of them are experiencing similar things, etc. Others would say, all right, so they all have a similar issue with their brain, and that's what's causing them to imagine these circumstances. And so this is going to tie into what we're talking about tonight in the sense that these individuals that believe that they have been abducted by aliens or have seen fairies, they all report very, very similar things. And the obvious question, that people ask is, it's a sort of chicken and egg sort of situation here. And that is, and by the way, it appears we have now been connected to our new transmission deal here. And so I'm going to do something, and hopefully we don't get dropped off the air here. But this is all experimental, and it is a way to hopefully help you hear all of this better. And so if I get dropped off the air, I will reconnect soon. But I'm gonna give something a shot right here. And so here we go. Crossing my fingers. I believe that we are still connected and going out over the Dark Matter Radio Network. So as I was noting here, there is a chicken and egg sort of question here. Are these people all experiencing something real, and that's why there are similarities in all of these accounts? Or is there something in the brains of certain individuals that caused them to have visions, all of which appear to be the same? And as we discuss this tonight, we're going to do tie-ins into all sorts of things, including something that we talked about a couple of weeks ago on the show, shamanism, and those that have experimented, for example, with ayahuasca or DMT, and have had visions. And it's the same sort of thing. If you drink ayahuasca, for example, and you believe that you have been sent to a different realm, and you see the machine elves, or you see the lizard, or any of the other things that, that people across all sorts of different time frames, nations, etc., all experience. Is this just some sort of vivid dream of some sort that everybody experiences in much the same way? Or does everybody really go somewhere else? And for those that have listened to this show and have listened to different shows on the Dark Matter Radio Network and heard discussions about quantum mechanics, for example, what is the nature of reality? There's some very interesting questions here, but we're going to be talking with Joshua Cutchin about that a little bit later here on the program. Also, another interesting topic here, this from LochNessMystery.blogspot.com. I found this this photo here. It's a very, very famous photograph, actually. You can Google this here, Loch Ness Monster. It is a photo of the famous F.C. Adams photograph. If you Google Loch Ness Monster and F.C. Adams, you can see a picture of this. Basically, it is an image that it says here it was taken between 1933 and 1960. And you can actually see a photograph of it here from the Illustrated London News. And essentially, this to me looks like a whale. And if you've ever seen a picture of a whale's dorsal fin, I mean, you've certainly seen something very similar to this F.C. Adams photograph. And it's kind of like the, it depends on how you look at it, what you interpret it as. If you're looking at this and you're thinking to yourself, this is a whale of some sort with a dorsal fin, that's exactly what you see. If you want to imagine looking at it the opposite way, that's a long neck and that's a hump, and this is something resembling a plesiosaur, well, you can imagine that as well. So in this article here at LochNessMystery.blogspot.com, they're examining the F.C. Adams photograph. And one of the obvious suggestions is that this is not the Loch Ness Monster. This is a whale of some sort. And my wife, of course, runs a nonprofit called Whale Scout. And so if you scroll down this article, you can see a number of different dorsal fins. There's like a dolphin dorsal fin right here. And you can kind of compare them to the photograph that was originally published in this newspaper. And the closest that I can come to a matching dorsal fin is not a porpoise or a dolphin, but rather an orca. And when I showed this to my wife, she thought it looked an awful lot like an orca. And if you scroll down here a little bit further, you can see some comparisons to an orca dorsal fin as well. And it does look very, very similar. Now, it does appear a little bit more rounded. This could be an issue with the original photograph, or orca whales, there are, around here in Washington State, we've got the southern resident orca whales. There's, I believe, 82 of them left. They're endangered. And essentially, what the scientists and, I guess, orca lovers, they actually call them dorkas, the people that really love these orca whales, what they do to determine which orcas are showing up is every orca has got a different saddle patch, which is kind of the white coloring on the black part of the orca, and also sort of a different shaped dorsal fin. And so, essentially, not every orca dorsal fin is the same. In fact, every single one of them is different. That's how the whales are identified. There literally are people who can go out and, you know, these orcas only surface for a brief period of time, but they can actually see the orca surface, and by looking visually at the dorsal fin, they can identify exactly which whale it is. And they've got these books where you can see every single one of the 82 dorsal fins. You can see all of the markings on each of them, and you can determine which whales are in your area when they come by. So the point of this whole story is, I firmly believe, from looking at this picture and from talking to my wife, that photograph there is probably of an orca. And I think the key to the entire story is, there is nothing in this picture that in any way suggests that this photograph was taken in Loch Ness. This photograph could have been taken anywhere. You can't see any, I mean, I know there have been people looking around for maybe a version of this photo that is less cropped. I mean, maybe if you could see some of the shoreline, obviously if you saw like Urquhart Castle or whatever it's called in the background, it'd be a pretty good indication that's Loch Ness. But really, all you can see is water and then whatever this thing is. So my guess is that most likely this was a photograph taken not in Loch Ness, somewhere else in the world. And then somebody sent it to the newspaper, or however this photograph came to the attention of the press. And this person claimed that the photograph was actually taken in Loch Ness. But I don't buy it. That's just me. I could be wrong. But I don't see anything in that picture that suggests that that right there is anything other than a whale. We're going to go to the phones. You are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
This is Ryan from Cumberland, Maryland.
Yes, Ryan.
Sort of have a favor to ask for your listeners. I came upon four very interesting videos that deal with the mind, and I think they're made by Brian Ladd, but they're actually posted by a guy named Kevin Scooter.
So they're posted by a guy named Kevin, but you believe that they have been posted by Brian Ladd under a fake name?
I think Kevin's the one that uploaded these, and maybe they're done illegally, or I don't know, but what they are is, I think they sort of rewire your brain, like one's for depression, one's for weight loss, one's for memory loss, and the other one is for happiness. Sort of afraid to actually like listen to these, and maybe a listener can do this, because it sort of has some side effects if you watch these videos, and they're rather long, they're about 8 hours and 7 minutes.
8 hours? So hold on a second. So you found videos online that if you watch them, they're supposed to bring you happiness, for example, or help with depression?
Supposedly, that's what they advertise, but I haven't been brave enough to actually watch them because I had so many problems with the drawings. I figured it might not be a good idea for me to get involved with this activity.
Okay, so let me pause for a second here. So you found a video that allegedly, if you watch it, it will help bring you happiness. But
that's what it advertises, but sometimes, you know, it is claimed to have side effects. Sometimes it gives like a warning label on these videos.
What would the possible side effects be of watching a video that is designed to bring you happiness?
I believe seizures was one of them.
Seizures? And so what you're asking is for listeners to perhaps watch these videos, and if none of them have a seizure, they can come in and give you the good news that you can now watch it.
Well, I'm just sort of more interested to see what happens when they get through with it. I think what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to get to sleep at night and maybe just listen to the sound of it is what the idea I'm getting.
I see. Well, Ryan, tell everybody how they can listen to one of these, for example. Don't give too many details, but give enough details that they could find it if they look for it.
Well, maybe I can just post it to your Twitter account. Maybe that will work.
Okay, let's do that. Post it to my Twitter, and if it looks like it's something that everybody could check out, I will tweet it out to everybody.
Okay, appreciate it.
All right, thanks, Ryan. Very concerned about Ryan. I think that maybe it would be a good idea to and maybe watch that one about happiness. Maybe there's one about paranoia. That might be a good one for Ryan to watch. So I guess he's sending that to my Twitter, at Brian Alvarez. Obviously, as you can tell, the phone lines are open. If you want to give us a call, the numbers are on the front page of AfterDarkRadioShow.com. So head up there and check that out and give us a call. Four numbers available here tonight, so let us hear what is on your mind. This from The Independent here. A couple more before we head to our interview. Earth enters its sixth extinction phase, with many of these species, including our own, labeled as the Walking Dead. We talked a little bit about this last week. The planet is entering a new period of extinction, with top scientists warning that species all over the world are essentially the Walking Dead, including our own. The report authored by scientists at Stanford, Princeton, and Berkeley found that vertebrates were vanishing at a rate 114 times faster than normal. Researchers note that the last similar event was 65 million years ago. And of course, if you watch Jurassic World, for example, you know what that means. That is when the dinosaurs disappeared, most probably as a result of an asteroid. One of the authors told the BBC, "We are now entering the sixth great mass extinction event. If it is allowed to continue, life would take many millions of years to recover, and our species itself would likely disappear early on." The research examined historic rates for extinction of vertebrates, finding that since 1900, So in a little more than the last 100 years, more than 400 vertebrates have disappeared. An extinction rate 100 times higher than in other non-extinction periods. There are examples of species all over the world that are essentially the walking dead, said Stanford University professor Paul Ehrlich. He added, we are sawing off the limb that we are sitting on. The research, which cites climate change, pollution, and deforestation as causes for the rapid change, note that a knock-on effect of the loss of entire ecosystems could be dire. 400 vertebrate species disappearing since 1900, the sixth extinction phase. We may be in it right now. To the phones, you are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Hi, this is David from Maryland.
Yes, David.
I would just like to start off by addressing what Ryan talked about a little bit earlier about this type of videos that have these deep, extreme wave frequencies. The slang term on YouTube is digital drugs, so if you just search for those, you can find them. And I've sent some to your Twitter page. I've tried them. They don't really do much. Generally, it's based off of your sensitivity to suggestibility as well as... if you're sensitive to, like, loud noises or very deep tones, like if you can't stand Beats headphones, these things aren't for you.
So what exactly... Oh, my God. Ryan's just sent me four tweets with four different videos.
That's
right,
impressive.
Here. Holy smokes. So explain this a little more to our listeners. What are you supposed to do here? You're supposed to listen to it while you sleep?
Or, like, when you're zoning out or meditating. I use it for my Zen meditation every morning, or at least I used to, but it doesn't really do much again. It's basically a really deep, droning sound, almost as if you've ever had your hearing tested, like in elementary school or something. So the idea is you want to put yourself into kind of like an isolated state and then listen to this thing, and eventually it should have some kind of effect on you, but... I think it's more due to the ritualistic activity of, you know, sequestering yourself and listening to these in a suggestible state.
Okay, I do remember. Okay, I kind of get it now. So I remember when I was in high school in physics class, one day that somebody turned on the strobe light gimmick, and I don't even know why, what the point was, but the room was dark, the strobe was going off, and whatever was happening, and all of a sudden, the kid sitting right in front of me, I just hear, and he fainted. Apparently, he had like a... I guess it's epilepsy, and if you have the so this affected him greatly. So that is why they give the warning that if you listen to this, you may be one of the rare people that has a side effect.
I think that's more of the case. Yes.
All right. So Ryan, the answer is you just gotta at your own risk, dude. Chances are you'll be fine, but you never know. You never know what might happen. So be careful, as always.
Mm-hmm.
All right, what's on your mind, David?
Okay, well, I came in today to talk to you about some of the research I've been doing towards Joshua Cutchin's book about a Trojan feast in terms of how it relates to Greek mythology. Like you said earlier, these myths, they have strong correlations in different cultures. So I happen to be somewhat of an expertish in Greek mythology, so I just wanted to present a very special case to you.
All right, let's hear it.
Well, it's the myth of Persephone and Hades in the underworld. See, back in the day, Greek mythology, when you wanted a wife, especially if you're Hades, dark god of the underworld, you basically live in the basement of the Greek pantheon. And see a cute girl, you're not going to court her, treat her nice, give her flowers and all that. You're just going to abduct her and take her to the underworld, similar to the... Cutchin's story about the little people and how they can take people. But while in the underworld, see, you have to follow the old rules of hospitality, I guess. And Persephone ended up eating about 6 or 7 pomegranate seeds while she was down there. So by accepting that type of food, again, going back to the Trojan feast, she kind of condemned herself to be trapped down there forever.
Have you read Josh's book yet?
Yes, it's actually in the mail. I read the preview chapter on Amazon.com.
Okay, so you haven't read the whole book yet?
Nope, I just thought this would be something that would relate.
Okay, well, the reason I bring it up is because this story is, in fact, in the book.
Oh, wow, perfect.
Oh, yeah, he goes all the way back, but go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Well, this idea of Persephone, she would really like this radio show because she's a possessor of dark and frightening wisdom sometimes. But she is also the harbinger of spring, appropriately, as the world gets a little warmer, as the, I guess, the first day of summer started today or yesterday. And it's also a reminder of growth and hope that rapid change like that can bring. Now, where this ties into my current investigations is I've received a lot of reports in my area of deer mutilations, as well as an albino deer. So there's actually a campground area.
Deer mutilations?
Yes, kind of like a cattle mutilation, but since the encroach of Beltway suburbia kind of eliminates a lot of ecological diversity and viable habitat, that's kind of the species that are restricted instead of cows.
Interesting.
Yes, so I have my trail cameras, and that's something ongoing that I will send you as soon as I get this thing on camera.
So you're setting up trail cameras?
Mm-hmm. Just like I did with the Skinwalker investigation, except this time I'm trying to capture just a deer, just a really creepy-looking deer. It's an albino.
Sure. Hey, mm-hmm. You're way better off trying to capture a deer on this trail cam than a Skinwalker.
Yeah. Speaking of which, going back to the idea of shamanism, when you start to, I guess, ingest those type of hallucinogens, isn't it a possibility that you're affecting those sight and eye processing parts of your brain? So if little people or people from the Seelie or Unseelie court, the Fae, if they're abducting you and maybe feeding you their own version of a very potent hallucinogen, that might affect your those same sensory areas a little stronger and a little bit differently.
Very possible. So when is this? Have you? I need to go back to these trail cams. Have you set up your trail cams yet?
Yes, they're up.
Okay. So you should have an answer by next week.
I believe so, yes.
All right. Well, listen, be careful. And as always, I'm less concerned about the deer and whatever's mutilating the deer. So watch out.
I will. Thank you, Brian.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. I always have to wish him well because he's always messing around with things that maybe he shouldn't be messing around with. And I want, of course, all of my listeners to be safe. The book, which we're going to be talking to the author Joshua Cutchin here in a moment about, is A Trojan Feast, The Food and Drink Offerings of Aliens, Fairies, and Sasquatch. Only three left in stock if you are trying to get the hard copy of A Trojan Feast. But hey, Kindle is available, $9.99, and they will not be out of stock of the Kindle version. And let me tell you something, as an author myself, of The Death of WCW, which is available at Amazon.com, we authors make a lot more money on the Kindle books than we do on the paperback or particularly the hardcover. So if you don't care what version you get, but you really want to support an author, Kindle versions, they make a lot of money. So I suggest that for A Trojan Feast. We are going to be back in just a moment. We're going to head to a commercial break. And when we return, we will be joined by Joshua Cutchin, the author of A Trojan Feast, the food and drink offerings of aliens, fairies, and Sasquatch, here on the new Sunday night edition of After Dark Radio, here on the Dark Matter Broadcasting Network. We are back here on After Dark Radio. Brian Alvarez here. After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Digital Network, now every Sunday, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern. And I am so happy today to be joined by Joshua Cutchin, the author of the new book, A Trojan Feast, The Food and Drink Offerings of Aliens, Fairies, and Sasquatch. And Joshua, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
I was telling you before before we went on the air that we were making the official move to Sunday, and I wanted a big guest. And honestly, I'm not saying this just because you're on the air, but at this moment in my life, I don't think I could have got a bigger guest personally than you, because let me explain something about this book and then we'll get into it. I don't want to waste too much time. I don't want to make this about me, but I do want to say something about the book that maybe some people listening to this at first will think this is quite a criticism of the book, but in fact, it's not. This is actually telling you how much I love this book. So when I read it, I have trained jiu-jitsu for a decade, and this is going to seem like a strange analogy, but I think it'll make sense. When you first start training jiu-jitsu, you don't know anything. You know nothing. And so every day that you go to class, it's something brand new to you, and it's exciting, and you can't wait to learn more, and you grapple with people that know more than you, and they tie you in a knot, and it doesn't bug you because you don't know anything. You're just a sponge learning all of this information. And then after a while, you get your first promotion and you become a blue belt. And blue belt is where a lot of people really start to have problems. Because all of a sudden, you know a little bit, and it's extraordinarily frustrating that you're still getting tied in knots, and you feel like you know enough that you should be better, but you see the long road ahead and everything that you don't know, and it can be frustrating to you. And I can kind of make a parallel to this book. Because when I was done reading this book, all I could think was, man, this book is awesome. And this Joshua Cutchin is onto something. But in a way, I'm even more frustrated now because I still don't get it. It seems like such a long road ahead to have any clue what is going on. But you've clearly discovered something here. And maybe even discovered is the wrong word, because as you note in the book, Jacques Vallée and many others have written things very much like this. And I was on a huge Jacques Vallée kick, and I stumbled upon your book, and I was just delighted to read it. So with all that said, let's get into the meat of this book. And first off, tell everybody a little bit about yourself and a little bit about the book.
Well, certainly, I'd be glad to. And that was a great analogy. I'm a classically trained musician, and half of the way that we learn things is through metaphors and such. So that made perfect sense to me. And it really is frustrating. But what to me is even in some ways more frustrating is that no one had thought to write a book like this until now, which sounds like I'm tooting my own horn. But really, the reason that this exists is because I had seen these parallels between fairy folklore, as you mentioned. Vallée had pointed a lot of this out. And it had always been one of the most fascinating things about the phenomena to me. But I saw this sort of food taboo running through all this sort of lore, the alien lore and the fairy lore, and even, to my surprise, the Sasquatch lore. And I kept on waiting for someone to write this book, and no one ever did. As I mentioned before, I'm a classically trained musician. Up until this past Wednesday, I was employed at the University of Georgia School of Music as their public affairs director. But with a lot of the success I've been getting with this book and a lot of the positive feedback, I have actually decided to pursue my writing further.
Wow.
Not just this, but also going to write some fiction work and really sort of double down on playing more music than I have. I still maintain a pretty healthy schedule playing music, but I want to really put all the chips in now. So it's a really exciting time in my life, and it's been wonderful to have talked to as many nice people in this field and kind people with kind things to say. So I'll add you to the list because your feedback is definitely inspiring.
Where did all of this begin?
Well, I've always had an interest in the deep tissue issues of the unexplained. I think it was Vallée who said if it was just little scientists coming down in spaceships, he was going to be disappointed. And while I don't necessarily share that exact sentiment, I think little scientists in spaceships would be super entertaining as well. I have found the parallels to fairy folklore to be some of the richest and most inspiring and most imagination-kindling aspects of this lore. So I have long had an interest in all these things. And I was actually reading J. Robert Alley's Raincoast Sasquatch, which I don't know if you've read that book, but it's a great book. And I stumbled upon a section in that where it talks about some First Nations folks in Canada having lore in their tribe that if you were to accept food from a Sasquatch, you would be trapped with the Sasquatch forever. And immediately this stuck
that?
In my mind. Yeah, it's so bizarre. And this immediately stuck in my mind the old fairy folklore of Europe, where if you took fairy food, you would be trapped in fairyland forever. Or if you could ever escape, you would crumble into dust when you did escape. So that to me, that was the point when I said, there's something else here. There's something else that we can look at here. And while people had dedicated chapters to it in the past, you know, there's that famous chapter in Passport to Magonia when Vallée mentions a lot of these things, no one had ever really tried to do a survey and analysis of the sort of foods that people said that they received from these entities and just to take a look at the data and see if any trends emerged. I took a stab at it, and I don't think it's perfect, but I think I think I personally have a better grasp on this aspect of the phenomena than I did before I wrote it, that's for sure.
I remember when I first saw the cover, and it mentioned the food and drink offerings of aliens, fairies, and Sasquatch. I remember thinking, okay, I'm in the boat here on the aliens and fairies. I hadn't read the book yet, but I thought, this is interesting, this tie-in with Sasquatch, because I don't know if I believe in Sasquatch. I mean, the best I will say is, I've mentioned a million times on the show, I've never had anyone adequately convince me that the Patterson footage is a hoax. And so because of that, I have an open mind. But when I really think about it, I'm not sold on it. However, I do feel that if Sasquatch exists, it's probably an animal. It's probably an ape. And so I thought, this is interesting, this attempt to tie this into Sasquatch, because I easily see the alien fairy tie, and I wasn't sold on the Sasquatch. And I do like how at the end of the book, you do kind of, it seems to me that your conclusion is, although there are some parallels, it does seem more likely that Sasquatch, if it exists, is a different sort of phenomenon and more likely an animal. Do you still kind of feel that way?
You know, it's, I feel like my good friend Micah Hanks when I say, I'm not really sure, I don't want to commit. But I do think that where the data ended up leading me was to the conclusion that, at least in this aspect of giving and receiving food, Sasquatch are an outlier. There are a lot of parallels between the sort of foods that are offered with aliens and fairies and their means of offering food, et cetera. But Sasquatch does seem to be on the periphery of those two phenomena. Sasquatch was included because of that food taboo that I had mentioned. I think that there is, even if there isn't a physical flesh and blood answer for Sasquatch, and quite honestly, the physical flesh and blood answer, I think, is kind of a tidy answer for a very untidy phenomena.
Sure.
I still think, you know, it's like I've said numerous times about the aliens and fairies and the aspects of them. Are they two sides of the same thing? Are they two different things using similar methods and means? You know, where on the Venn diagram do they touch? So I think that there's some sort of connection there. I don't know if it means that it's a physical entity with a connection, or it's a spiritual entity for a connection. I really, you know, I tried to sort of let the data shove me in the direction that it wanted to, as opposed to coming to it with any preconceived notions. And it's kind of funny that you mentioned being frustrated at the end and saying, there's still so much we don't know. Yeah, I mean, there is really quite a bit that I have to throw up my hands and say, I don't know what these phenomena are, but anyone who says that there is not a connection between aspects of these things isn't really evaluating the data with an open mind, in my opinion.
It's not even it's not like a disappointed frustration. It's not like I sat there and thought, oh man, Josh, why didn't you figure this out, for crying out loud? It's more like it seems like you hit so much on the head, but we still don't know what this is all about. That's the frustration that I had, and it's certainly nothing directed at you.
No, and I absolutely understand that, and to me, it's almost like, in some ways, it's the opposite. It's almost an inspiring sort of, the more we learn, the less we know, because...
It feels we're closer.
I've heard a lot of people nowadays talking about how ufology has gotten a little bit long in the tooth, and it's not really doing everything that it could, and it's not, you know, it's due for a reimagining. But to me, this is exciting because I see several little pockets like this that we've sort of just as a community overlooked, and I think that there's a phrase that I ended up using towards the end of the book. I feel like we're not seeing the trees for the forest, to flip the old adage on its head. I think that maybe somewhere in the minutia, we can actually learn something about the greater phenomena as a whole. And, you know, I think that there's a lot of things, that a lot of different areas that we could go into that are even sort of brought up in the book. And I don't have the time in the book to even completely address, because this is something that has sort of gone overlooked. So there's the idea of ghost food, you know.
That's right.
Which I think, again, I'm not saying that aliens and fairies and ghosts and Sasquatch are all the same thing, but I'm saying that, you know, there are certain similarities that you see there. And, you know, I don't really go into ghost food at all in the book. And mostly because I couldn't find a ton of reliable stories. But still, I think that there's something to look at in that as well. So, yeah, it's like this sort of encouraging frustration, because I think this field is a lot more wide open than even we realize.
Going back to Sasquatch here very quickly, because I got a couple of comments, and then we'll move on to elves and fairies and aliens. I have heard many Sasquatch researchers, and it's kind of funny when you think about it, close their mind altogether to the idea that Bigfoot could be anything other than some sort of animal, some sort of ape. I mean, they'll flat out say, you know, we get some reports that have kind of a paranormal aspect to them, but we don't investigate them because we believe it's an animal. And there's kind of that part of me that thinks, we don't know that. We don't know anything about Sasquatch. We know nothing about it. So if you're really looking at this from a scientific point of view, I mean, you should at least address that sometimes you get reports with a weird paranormal aspect to it. You can't throw those out because you believe that it's an animal when you don't know, right?
Right. No, I completely, you know, I'll be honest, and this is probably the first time that I've said this in a public forum. I really, really want, if I'm honest about what I want the data to reveal, I want Sasquatch to be a flesh and blood creature, because that means we can, you know, we can wrap our heads around it, and we can figure it out. But you know, there are a lot of strange things that happen that you can't throw away. There's one particular podcast that I really do enjoy that I listen to. I'm not going to necessarily name its name, but whenever they have people who mention some of the quirkier or stranger aspects of Sasquatch encounters, like people who claim telepathy or claim disappearing, they automatically write those people off as being, the term that they use is flute players. I suppose that's a way of making fun of the New Age community. But, you know, these are the same individuals who, in their Sasquatch encounter that they claim to have had with their flesh and blood Sasquatch, they thought that the experience lasted 45 minutes, and it turns out it lasted 4 hours. Well, that's sort of a variation on missing time, isn't it?
Sure.
You know, so I feel like until there's a body, we just don't know. And I feel like we all need to just say, look, I feel like we need to be open as a community and say, look, there are a lot of things that make this look like a physical entity, you know, make it look like an ape. But then there are these strange outliers, and you know, it's always the outliers that tend to prove things. You can have 100 white swans, and that doesn't necessarily mean that all swans are white. But you have one black swan, and it guarantees that all swans aren't necessarily always white. So, that's sort of a roundabout way of, I hope I answered the question.
Sure. Well, I mean, I feel it's more likely that a Sasquatch would be an animal. But if you look at all of the reports and the fact that no one's ever been able to take a good photograph, maybe with the exception of the Patterson film, and you never find a body and you never find anything.
Yeah.
I mean, that seems more paranormal than physical.
Yeah. And I think it's all about, I mean, I would agree with that statement too. Again, it's the tidiness of the biological theory. But I feel like there are angles that we haven't even started to think about. I mean, people do sort of jump through hoops to say, well, maybe Sasquatch bury their dead, or maybe they're just really good at hiding. But, you know, I'm not writing any of that off. I think it comes down to is we really still have no idea. We can say that there are certain trends that emerge and certain things that you would expect, a strange smell, the feeling of being watched. And there might be biological answers for a lot of the seemingly supernatural abilities that Sasquatch has. But to say that we know that it's a biological ape is incorrect, and to say that we know that it's a spirit being is also incorrect. I really wish
we don't know anything.
I wish that, you know, and this is sort of an ideological thing, but I really, really wish that you know, in every aspect of life, we could sit with ambiguity a little bit more comfortably.
I have always been very skeptical of the idea that UFOs are craft that are coming here from another planet. I've always been interested in UFOs, but it just kind of seems sort of strange. Like, I'll just give you just a quick example. I mean, mm-hmm. the story of Roswell. I mean, the very idea that some craft traveled interstellar space, something that we are completely incapable of doing to any real degree, traveled from God knows where, God knows how, and the first thing that happened when it got here is it was struck by lightning and crashed. It's like, really? It just seems kind of kind of strange to me. So I've never really been a big believer in the idea that these are crafts from elsewhere. So when I was younger and I read Dimensions by Jacques Vallée, and the book was all about, I mean, it was, this came after Passport to Magonia. The book was all about, you know, all these UFO stories you hear. They're very, very similar to these stories that we've been hearing for centuries about fairies, elves, even religious icons. These are all the same thing. It's just each generation or whatever calls it whatever seems to be most likely for that generation. A phenomenon that we cannot explain, but it has obviously been here forever. And when I first read that, I just thought, this dude knows what he's talking about. I don't know what this is, but he's hit on something right here. Did you kind of have that same thing when you were, when did you first read Jacques Vallée? Did you kind of, or where was it that you first kind of started reading about this sort of thing?
Well, you know, I have had this interest probably since about middle school. And a lot of what I was reading at the time was very tertiary stuff. I have an interest in so many different aspects of Fortiana that I really tended to gravitate towards some of the more encyclopedic books, like a lot of those written by Jerry Clark.
Sure.
But I really didn't get into Vallée probably until the past, I'd say, 5 years or so. And whenever you read his work, it really does sort of completely bust open your paradigm of what you think this entire phenomena is. You know, I think it's interesting. You mentioned, is the phenomena recontextualizing to fit with the culture in which it appears, or does the culture recontextualize the phenomena? You know, is there a take all answer to this, or are there multiple answers? I think that if we really dug down deep, we might well find that there are. You know, I think we can all agree that there are multiple answers to UFOs right off the bat. Some of them are misidentifications, and some of them are legitimately anomalous. But even within the legitimately anomalous, what if there are multiple explanations within that? What if some of it is, has to do with altered states? What if some of it is indeed extraterrestrials? And what if some of it is indeed, you know, time travel quantum quirkiness? You know, I think that there might be a hodgepodge of explanations, and Vallée tends to really find a good way of sitting with that mystery and just sort of embracing it that I really have always admired.
When a person first starts to read Jacques Vallée and they read about the tie-ins between what we call UFOs today and what people called fairies or gods or whatever in other times, I think a lot of people start to fixate on things like, well, supposed aliens and supposed fairies, they were small. And UFOs leave these crop circles, and fairies danced in fairy rings.
Yep.
And they make these obvious tie-ins here. But you, the book, obviously, A Trojan Feast, you zeroed in on the food taboo, which I'd always heard of the food taboo in fairy lore. Obviously, if you go to fairyland, don't eat the food because you'll never come back. I hadn't really tied it in so much to the UFO phenomenon, which you do very, very well here in this book. What caused you, and you mention all of the things, obviously, the size of the things, shape of the head, etc. What caused you to really zero in on food, the food taboo?
Well, you know, for me, it was the fact that a lot of these encounters, especially with aliens and with fairies, in truth, tend to be described as being very brief. And although in some occasions in fairy lore, the offering of food could be ascribed to extending hospitality, other times someone would meet a fairy along a road at night and it would offer some wine or something. Similarly, if you look at abduction lore, a lot of times people are being taken for a relatively short amount of time. I mean, you look at what the human body can withstand. I think the generic rule is the rule of four. And my apologies to anyone in the audience if I didn't get that quite right. But 4 days without water, 4 four minutes without air, 4 days without water, and 4 weeks without food. So the question is, why are people claiming to be taken aboard a spacecraft and being given a liquid when they're only there for 4 hours? They could certainly withstand that experience without starving to death or thirsting to death. So the question is there some reason that is not obviously apparent for why this is being administered? And I think if you look at it enough, especially again in the alien and fairy lore, it's less for sustenance and more to produce some sort of effect. So that's really where that linkage comes in together. And then if you look into sort of the variations of what people, receive in alien lore, it sort of branches out not only from food and drink, but they're also curious ointments. And one of the ways that you could actually see the invisible fairy realm in a lot of European folklore was to actually put fairy ointment upon your eyes. So again, there's this interesting little connection, and I think that when you look at it, it's just again, it's rich and it's rewarding, but it's also quite confounding because sometimes it's hard to come to any sort of solid conclusion.
I thought it was interesting because I always saw the parallels, the crop circles, the small size, the missing time, but there were some parallels that you mentioned in your book that I just thought were astonishing to me. The crop circle fairy ring parallel, for example. Today we call them crop circles, and we presume that these circular crafts landed in a field and created these designs, or whatever people think crop circles are. And of course, hundreds of years ago, when people saw something like that, they presumed, well, this must be where the fairies danced. That was their conclusion, based on what they believed at the time. And I thought it was interesting that in the book you mentioned that many UFO abductees today will talk about how they were given a pill. And if you look back at fairy lore, oftentimes people will be fed wafers. And you think about the idea of a wafer, and as you note in the book, maybe they were also being fed pills.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, they didn't understand what a pill was, and so the description they gave for it was a wafer. And when you really start to think about that, you go back and you look at a lot of these older reports, and you really start to think, were all of these people that allegedly were given wafers or beans or whatever they called them, they were actually being given pills, and they had no other word for it.
Right. I mean, language is such a confounding issue in this. And it's one of those reasons why I tried to put it in as quantitative a study as I could. You really did have to sort of get qualitative because with varying cultures, the way that things might be described might vary widely. You know, one culture might perceive something as pleasant, while another culture might perceive something as unpleasant. But, it's entirely possible that a lot of these things that were received. Just again, it's this idea of recontextualization. You know, what would a person in the Middle Ages have thought of an injection? You know, they might have described it in completely different terms, having never really encountered many syringes in their lives, depending on where and when they were visited by these fairies.
Ezekiel's wheel.
Yeah.
Who knows what this guy saw? He had no way to describe it except clouds and animal faces.
Exactly. And you know, we're just constantly grasping at language for what this is. And, you know, I think in some ways, language is sort of a virus that spreads through culture. It permeates. We exist within a realm of language. And if our language can't describe what we're seeing, how do we even know that we can objectively perceive of it in its true form and its true nature? How much co-creation is going on between what people are seeing and the way that they're interpreting it, because they actually lack a way to sort of process this image of the other.
Another thing that was very interesting, and maybe you could give some examples here, is, and this kind of can get a little frustrating too when you think about the bigger picture. There are so many reports, whether it be fairies, gods, aliens, whatever the observer identified it as, that maybe in some way, make a little bit of logical sense based on the time period. The airship mystery of the late 1800s, where people reported these airships and the airships landed. And to the observer of that period, this all made sense to them. I mean, they didn't understand the airships, but I mean, the airships had pistons and rudders, what you would see on a boat, basically. Mm-hmm. And it made sense to them that, well, if you made a flying machine, it would also have an oar or whatever. And you look at it through modern eyes and it's like, okay, this was a very, very good report, but there is an aspect of it that is completely preposterous. You've got the report of an alien landing in the 50s, and they've got some helmet on with a giant antenna. I've got an iPhone here. You can't even see the antenna. Why?
Exactly.
Yeah, why would there be big cartoon-like antennas? So my point is, all of these stories have an aspect to them that is preposterous. And I guess talk a little bit about that, and then I'll bring up my second part of the issue with things being so crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Sometimes I wonder if, first of all, I'd like to say that the more bizarre a tale is, the more I'm probably inclined to believe in it, because if I were going to fabricate from whole cloth an alien abduction tale, it would involve some of these ridiculous details.
Sure.
It wouldn't be a story like Joe Simonson and his pancakes that he received. It would be a very traditional story that really adhered to our cultural meme. But sometimes I wonder if these truly high strange tales that people tell are to be believed on face value and interpreted the way that the witnesses interpreted them, if maybe the absurdity is, you know, deliberate.
It seems it has to be.
Yeah, I really do. You know, I really do think that there might be something to that. I mean, you look at the way that fairies used to kind of pick on people who drank a lot of alcohol. I don't know if that what that says. I don't know if there's somehow a dropping of the veil when people consume these substances, or if they're deliberately picking out people who are on the fringe, people who might not be believed. You know, picking out people whose stories are less or more likely to be shrugged off. You know.
So that brings me to the other aspect of this, which is, so let's say that I got abducted and a bunch of really crazy things happen, and I come back and I'm telling my story, and even though I firmly believe that what occurred really happened to me, maybe there's that part of me that thinks, okay, the deal with the giant talking sunflower, you know, maybe I'll just leave that detail out, because I mean, if that's really one that's going to kill my credibility. And you sort of start to think, we've heard weird details for many, many of these stories, but we also don't know how many people didn't tell us about a detail so preposterous that they didn't feel that they could explain that to anybody. They kept that detail to themselves. And maybe there's a vast trove of information that maybe truly is valid, but we're never going to know, because there are things that people just won't tell, even if they tell the rest of the story.
That's a quite insightful point, and one that I had never considered. But you really kind of blew my mind with that. I mean, it's sort of a variation on what people say about, oh, only a certain X percentage of people who encounter these things go and report them. But that's an interesting wrinkle that I hadn't really considered. I guess the assumption is that if people are willing to come out about the encounter, that they'll go ahead and include everything about it. But that's a really good point.
Well, I mean, think of how many people say, I mean, there are, I'm sure, millions that have had an experience and they never told anybody because they do the obvious. Well, no one is going to believe me. So
right.
Then you narrow it down to the number of people that, okay, something happened to me and, okay, I'm going to find someone who I think will believe me. But there's no guarantee that every aspect of the story, maybe there was something that was particularly embarrassing to them. I mean, you mentioned in the book there's a sexual aspect to a lot of this stuff. And, you know, a lot of people will tell that portion of the story, but maybe there was a part of the story that to them was just so embarrassing. It's like, I'll kind of give a cursory description of what happened, but I'm going to withhold this little part right here. And maybe there's a lot of valuable information that we have just never heard because people find it too ridiculous.
Yeah, absolutely. And sort of a variation on that. You know, how many people are not only not telling things because they're embarrassed, but legitimately telling things, but completely misinterpreting the purpose of it.
Sure.
You know, I mean, I think that in some cases we might even contextualize some of these purported sexual angles as being sexual, but they might actually, to whatever this alien intelligence is, not necessarily alien as an extraterrestrial, but just alien as an other, it might have a purpose that is completely removed from sexuality. I mean, there was a great line in there was a great line from House of Cards, the first season, where he says, everything's about sex except for sex, which is about power. So, you know, you wonder if maybe the purpose behind a lot of these things that happen isn't in itself sort of occluded from people being able to really interpret what its true purpose is.
Well, you mentioned in the book the analogy to animals in the sense that, humans like to think that we're at the pinnacle. It's always been like this. And if there is an intelligence out there that is significantly greater than ours, then us sitting here thinking that we've got it figured out and we know why things happen, it would be ridiculous. It would be like our pets. Like, I'm sure we do. Trust me, I do plenty of things that my cats have no idea what I'm doing or why. Just baffled by me. I'm just a big clumsy cat in their eyes, and I do all this weird stuff. They have no idea. And you think about the idea of a greater intelligence playing some sort of whatever it is that they're doing, some grand experiment, some trick, pure amusement on their end. We have no idea what could possibly be going on. And it is a good analogy with animals. Our behavior is looked upon by an animal.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. We always want to ascribe some sort of really grand purpose behind things, but what if these things are, you know, larks? Late Mac Tonies used to talk about how a cat chasing a laser pointer was somewhat analogous to humans seeing UFOs, and I feel like, you know, whenever you're playing with an animal and a laser pointer, you're just trying to entertain them or just entertain yourself. There's no greater meaning behind it. It's just you know, a lark. So I think that there's some value in not keeping yourself from thinking that way. Really be open to all these options and trying to determine whether or not there is or isn't a bigger purpose behind this.
I honestly feel I'm smarter than my cats. I may be wrong, but we have hardwood floors here, and I can lay one of them on its side and slide it all the way across the hardwood to the other side. And it will run back to me, and I'll do it again. It'll run back to me, and I'll do it again. And there is no higher intelligent purpose to what I'm doing. I think it's funny. That's it. There's no grand scheme. There's no grand idea. It's purely for my own amusement. And I don't think that the idea should be discounted, that whatever is going on is being done strictly for a greater intelligence's pure amusement.
Yeah, I mean, I actually really do love a lot of aspects about that because... I mean, if you think about the mindset that pets are in with their owners, a lot of what we do has to appear completely nonsensical. A lot in the same way that people who encounter these entities see nonsensical things happen or even non-logical things. The idea that maybe something could be so far beyond our actual comprehension of what is logical and what seems to make sense is, I think, a really appealing metaphor for the whole of the phenomena.
Let's take everybody through a generic look at an abduction, whether it be a fairy, an alien, some religious icon of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
What is the, and obviously, I mean, I guess there is sort of a generic abduction experience. What do people report across all ages, countries, etc.?
No, I think you can definitely make even setting aside the way that the phenomena recontextualizes itself, I think you can walk away with some definite trends. I mean, usually a person is alone, usually, not always. Usually they're in an isolated area or an area that is that they don't have, you know, access to other individuals. Oftentimes, this is at night. Oftentimes there is a bright light associated with the phenomena, and from that, either emerging from or accompanied by that bright light. I'm saying this in general for both fairy and alien encounters. Less so Sasquatch. Again, Sasquatch is sort of an outlier in this. Emerging from or associated with that bright light would be small entities, and then there's generally some sense of cessation of time, whether or not that means someone feeling as though they're transported to a different place or feeling as though they're in an altered state, then this is accompanied, and this is something that I found really interesting in my research, is how once people are taken to a different space, in both fairy and alien lore, these shorter beings are accompanied by a taller overseer being. That's a motif that appears quite a few times.
That's right.
In fairy lore as well. And generally the person is there. Sometimes there is a medical examination, or sometimes there's just this relaying of information that has been withheld from the rest of the world, and they'll be returned back to their original space, often with a sense of amnesia, but almost always with a difference in time that is much greater than what they have perceived to have passed during this experience. And again, those are very much consistent across both fairy and alien encounters. Sasquatch encounters are a little bit different. You still have this sense of isolation and this sense of being out in the wilderness, but a lot of times in the credible Sasquatch encounters, that Sasquatch abductions that I ran across, a lot of times people were held for much longer periods of time, several days. A lot of times there seems to be either a motive behind the abduction that is either for procreation or for dietary reasons, holding someone captive to be eaten later. And then there's usually an escape. Very rarely are people willingly let go, as they are in alien and fairy encounters. One crucial difference to the fairy encounter is that when people were released from the fairy realm, oftentimes they would crumble into dust, often when they've had their first earthly meal. So,
couple of specific things I wanted you to touch on. First off, something you didn't mention, but I thought it was interesting, was very often there's a buzzing noise. Mm-hmm. And again, I don't know what's going on. I don't know if it's aliens, fairies, interdimensional beings, someone's imagination. I don't know what is responsible for this phenomenon. But the fact that something like buzzing is reported in so many cases indicates to me that there's something happening to these people, because this is so common and so weird. Buzzing? Like, what is the buzzing? It seems like it has to be, to me, things like that convince me that something's going on. I don't know what it is, but it's too commonly reported to, like, why would someone make that aspect of it up, that there was a weird buzzing? They just kind of mention it offhandedly, and so many people do, that there must be something happening.
Right, and if I could take a quick moment to commend you for being able to admit the fact that you aren't sure what's going on. I think we all need to do that a little bit more. Yeah, it's buzzing is one of those interesting aspects of the phenomena that I find really fascinating, because it's not that often depicted in popular media. So if you see a television show or a film where there's an alien abduction, oftentimes you won't see buzzing. You won't see the larger, taller, supervising entity getting up in someone's face and trying to convey love. Yet these are still motifs of this phenomena. So the question is, if someone is making it up, how are they, unless they're really involved in this field and are reading about this, how are they able to pick up on these less popularized aspects of the experience? To the subject of buzzing in particular, I had mentioned that I feel like if you're not looking at fairy lore and alien lore and saying that there is a connection there, then you're not really just paying attention to the data. Again, not saying that they're the same thing, just that there is a connection there. And similarly, if you take a look at a lot of these alien and fairy encounters and experiences that people report under the influence of hallucinogens and entheogens, and if you can take a look at that and say that there's not a connection there, then again, you're just not looking at what a lot of the data says, because one of the things that a lot of people report when they're under the influence of certain hallucinogens, in particular ayahuasca, in particular DMT, is this strange buzzing sound, this buzzing in the ears that seems to become at the beginning of the encounter. So, I think that it's a very tantalizing clue that there's something to to sort of unpack between the altered state of consciousness and the UFO phenomena as a whole.
We're going to get to that ayahuasca here before we wrap it up, because I got not a first person, but a second person experience. And so I want to talk to you about that. But
awesome.
Another aspect is the message. People are often given a message, and it's often ridiculous. And I don't know what that means. I don't know if that means that if someone says that they were taken to Saturn and the people that lived there gave them a message about how the end of the world was near, and they came back home, and this, by the way, was the 50s, we'll just say, and clearly the end of the world has not come yet. Were they just completely making that up? Or what did something happen to them, and whatever was responsible just thought they'd have a field day with this goofy message? Because many people get these messages that end up being, I mean, they're worthless. They're completely worthless yeah. messages. And on the other hand, I'm sure you can talk about this. There have been many religious apparitions that have been reported in places like Mexico, which have had very specific messages, such as you've got to build a big church here. And if the person doesn't do it, the thing keeps coming back until they get word out that a church needs to be built here. And the next thing you know, the church is built and it's just worshipped forever. But another strange message. Why a church there? What's the point?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think that a lot of, when you sort of look at the messages that people tend to receive, we especially in today's very scientific paradigm, want statements to be true. And I think we think less about it, what the statements mean. And as, you know, an artist myself, I wonder sometimes if someone being told that the world is going to end is less of the entity telling them that there's something awful happened, and more to produce, again, to produce an effect in that person. Like, okay, well, maybe the world isn't going to end, but how does that statement affect that person's life after the encounter?
So it's a personal message to the person that they decide they're going to spread, but really it was mostly just intended for them.
Possibly. I mean, you know, it's this idea of maybe looking at, I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Greg Bishop, but Greg often talks about the idea, what if UFOs are the way that the universe produces art? Could you think of something that produces, you know, if the purpose of art is to invoke an emotion in someone and to change them, could you think of something more profound than the UFO experience? You know, marriages have been lost from sightings. People's lives have been changed and people have been put on spiritual paths. People have questioned the very nature of their reality all because of these experiences. So what if that is really the purpose behind it? I don't know if it is or not. I think it's a fascinating idea to entertain. And that does, to me, help explain some of the less logical aspects of the phenomena.
And the other thing that people often report, which I have been really fascinated with lately, because I can't remember where I read it. It might have been in Jacques Vallée. It might have been Passport to Magonia. But Albert Einstein's theory of relativity, this was a 20th century discovery. And we, of course, have since learned that if you travel on a spacecraft near the speed of light and return, I mean, the amount of time that has passed for you as compared to someone who stayed here on Earth is going to be vastly different. Mm-hmm. This is a modern scientific discovery. But if you go back into the fairy lore, that's missing time. It's all relativity. This person felt like they'd been gone for 4 hours. They come back and 100 years had passed. Where would a story like that pop up out of somebody's imagination hundreds of years ago?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. And in some ways, I find these phenomena less interesting than the actual stories that have evolved around them and what those stories say about us. And I feel like to a lot of this folklore, there is a grain of truth, you know? I mean, yes. A lot of people have said that there's the face of a man in the moon, but the reason that they say that is not because there's the face of the man in the moon, but it does vaguely sort of look like a face. These things don't generally just spontaneously arise from nowhere. There's usually some sort of basis for it. And I think as we, you know, there was a study this past October that proved that it was basically further proving the observer effect, but the observer effect actually extending to atoms. At the atomic level, which basically means that a lot of times reality isn't doesn't decide what it wants to be until we observe it. So, I think that we are too trapped in this idea of what is objective and subjective. I'm not convinced that anything is really truly objective, and that there might not even be a place in between the objective and the subjective.
So in the book, you work up towards the talk of ayahuasca, DMT, psychedelics. And of course, throughout the book, you talk about the giving and taking of food. That's one of the keys to the entire book. And this, of course, ties into shamans who give ayahuasca, for example. And the person who drinks this goes on what feels like a journey. And the journey that they take has a lot of tie-ins, a lot of similarities to reports of those who have been abducted by aliens and fairies. First off, I guess talk a little bit about what your average person drinking ayahuasca reports and how that ties into these other two encounters.
Be glad to. It's interesting. A lot of these people who do take ayahuasca, not a majority, but it has been known from time to time where people are approached within the ayahuasca dream state. They're approached by entities and offered food. Even Graham Hancock, during a session, I believe, in 2013, was offered food by some various entities and remembered the food taboo and decided that he would abstain from that. But generally what happens is under the supervision of a shaman, someone is given the ayahuasca. And they'll experience basically an altered state that generally the visions include imagery of the jungle, the serpent, the jaguar, and throughout the course of their interaction with these visions, they learn a lot about themselves, and it's actually referred to as a medicine among the indigenous people of the Amazon River Basin because of the way that it has a purgative quality, meaning that you will vomit and defecate, basically losing all your fluids. But that, to the people who actually use this in a medicinal basis, say that that is the way of the medicine, cleaning out the negativity from your body. But again, people will experience the buzzing when they have ayahuasca. They will experience a sense of altered states. One thing that people tend to run into, I actually spoke with a gentleman who ran into some short little things that he described as leprechauns that wanted him to come with them and have a drink. And his supervising shaman had to intervene at the last minute. Was apparently, according to this gentleman, very concerned that he was about to go have a drink with those leprechauns that he saw. So people will see these small entities, and a lot of times, as part of the cleaning process of cleaning their self, they'll be disassembled and put back together, which is a common shamanic motif of being put back together better than you were before. And of course, there are clear parallels to that in alien lore.
I was really fascinated by that chapter because when my wife was in college, she went to Peru, and her class, they all went and visited a shaman, and they all took ayahuasca. And so she
really
had the experience. And she actually did not vomit or anything, but she did feel terribly sick. And she, I don't remember everything that she saw, but it was a deal where she did come out of it with a new perspective on a lot of things. And after I read the book, I basically asked her, I mean, my big question was basically, and I've always wondered about this too, because when people talk about psychedelics and these journeys they go on, the question is, if you really want to open your mind and believe, was this an experience purely in your brain, or did you visit somewhere else? And so
My
basic question to her, I wanted to phrase it in a way where I didn't sound crazy, but I said, did it feel like a dream, or did it feel like you really went to another world? Like, forget what you think happened. What did it feel like? And she essentially said it felt like a really intense dream where you can't tell if you're sleeping or if this is real. But when you wake up, you do know right away that it was a dream, and you don't have that thing where when you wake up, you go, was that a dream or did that really happen? But she said, when your eyes are closed, you're totally there and
right,
it feels real. But you can open your eyes at any time and you'll be back. And then you close your eyes and you're immediately back again. And apparently it's just weird. I have no other way to describe it.
Yeah. That's actually the way that Graham Hancock had the entities go away, is that he decided to open his eyes. It really all comes down to, from what I can tell and from what I've been told, it really comes down to set and setting, and it comes down to how the individual reacts. I think it was, I may be misspeaking, but I think Dennis McKenna actually tried ayahuasca the first time and didn't experience anything. But I think a lot of that is tied to the actual individual experience itself. You know, I again, in keeping with my theme of being on the fence, I'm not sure if it's an objective reality. I'm not sure that for our conversation, it has to be an objective reality. You know, again, if the purpose is to create,
I don't even know what an objective reality would even be. I don't even know if it exists.
I know, right? I mean, we're always filtering the objective through the subjective. You know, I'm not really seeing this cup here on my desk. I'm seeing light bouncing off the cup that's coming through my eyes, and this is the way that my brain has interpreted it. Culture has told me this is what a cup is, and so I say cup. You know, like that dress that took over the internet a couple months ago,
blue and black,
or white and gold.
Yeah.
You know, it's
it was really white and gold, by the way. I just want to throw that out there.
Fisticuffs. That sounds like a fascinating opportunity that your wife had. And, I have not, and again, I'm sure some people would say that I shouldn't be writing about this if I haven't done it, but I actually have not done any of these substances, mainly because I have some health issues that give me pause. And, you know, it's also illegal too. So, But that sounds like a fascinating opportunity that she had, and I would love to talk to her sometime about it.
Sure, if she were here, I'd put her on after this. So, I guess one other thing before we start to wrap it up here, as we talk about ayahuasca and DMT, one of the potential conclusions, I guess, would be the best way to say it, that you have drawn, that you've been thinking about, is when we speak of these entities in the giving of food. Maybe there's a deal where what the entities are doing is in some way giving us something akin to an ayahuasca or a DMT that opens up the path of communication between us and them. Is that kind of a safe way to phrase it?
That is. I think we have to be a little bit cautious here, because while the entity food, the act of giving and receiving food is not uncommon, it doesn't happen in every experience.
Sure.
So the idea is that food is being administered to create contact with this other thing. That quickly falls apart, because a lot of people don't report remembering taking something. But I think that there is a similar role to play. You know, I think that you look at the frequency of the food being given at the beginning or at the end, rarely in the middle of these encounters, says something to the nature of the food actually being able to put people into an altered state. And, you know, it's interesting. Ayahuasca itself is sort of an entity food that we can examine ourselves, because every native person in the Amazon Basin, every culture says that this was actually given to them by a higher power. So
sure. Now, the big question that I had when reading about that, and as you note, I mean, this is not like, I mean, there are issues in the sense that, as you noted, many of these reports that it was not the giving and taking of food. But
right.
my question would be, to me, if I ran across a fairy, I would have had to already have been in the altered state. You know what I mean? As opposed like, how did I come in contact with a fairy and then he gave me something that put me into an altered state? Like, something must have happened where I saw the fairy in the first place.
Well, and more to the point, I mean, here's a question for you. Would you take a strange drink from a guy that you met at, you know, on the subway?
No, I don't take strange drinks from anybody, much less fairies.
And yet you have these people, supposedly in a lot of cases, under their own volition, taking this food. It does seem to me that people are already in that altered state when they take it. You know, I mean, I sure as hell wouldn't take something from somebody on the subway. Nevertheless, a gray alien or a little leprechaun that I met on the side of a road, you know.
You know, one thing that you didn't mention in your book, but I just thought about it right now, is many people have noted that there are certain places where things like this happen with great regularity. And usually, it's a place where it's so well known that the place ends up getting a name, a Devil's Point. Devil pops up all the time in these places where these things are always occurring. Maybe there's something to the idea that in certain places, for whatever reasons that we don't understand, some people, when they are there, for whatever reason, end up entering into an altered state. At which point, I mean, listen, I would not take anything from anybody, and I very, very rarely drink. But back when I drank more, if I were drinking and somebody handed me another drink, I'd probably drink it.
Yeah.
So could it be that there are places on this earth where these things have been reported, flap areas, I guess they used to be called, where when you're there, maybe there's something that causes you to enter an altered state, at which point you can be approached by something that will offer you more. And now you're sort of in the mood, so to speak, to give it a shot. And then you're really down the rabbit hole.
No, I think that's another great observation. And, you know, I think that idea sort of dovetails with the frequency for this food to occur at the end of an encounter. Like, okay, well, you know, you were able to, this area made you feel this way, but now it's time, we have decided as the other, we have decided that it's time for you to leave. Here, drink this, and this will kick you out of this state, you know.
And I seem to recall, I don't remember all the details, I probably shouldn't talk about this, but I think she mentioned something about how they ask you to take ayahuasca on an empty stomach, because I guess there's less of a chance of vomiting everything if you don't have anything in your stomach. And then at the end, I guess you are supposed to eat something or something like that. So it almost seems like there's kind of that tie-in in the sense that after the encounter is over, you're given something to eat, which maybe then when you've got something in your stomach, the effects of whatever this is start to dissipate.
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely foods that all ayahuascaras will recommend that you abstain from. And I actually heard, I just heard this the other day, and it was something that I really wish I could have included in the book, but I heard, I just heard this apocryphally, so I don't know if it's true or not, but I've heard that salt will actually help you come out of that altered state.
And really?
If that is true, it really ties in quite nicely with the idea of salt being a prophylactic against all sorts of paranormal phenomena.
That's right. Tell everybody about that. The idea that the alleged food of the fairies was always sort of reported as no salt, and salt was used to keep them away.
Yeah, a lot of people will attribute this to the fact that salt prevents decay, and in that sense, if there were fairies around who were often associated with the dead, that salt would therefore also keep the fairies away. But salt in general has had a very important relationship in certain hospitality rites. And the interesting thing is that very rarely are any of these foods that I have mentioned described as salty. Like, very rarely, as in I found like less than 5 cases where somebody said, well, I had a salty drink.
Sure.
Another sort of interesting riff on this is that people have said that this new research has suggested that an imbalance of electrolytes could be one of the contributing factors to sleep paralysis. So is it a possibility that this idea of salt preventing paranormal activity really tied into to some actual scientific knowledge? Sort of a parallel to your anecdote about the theory of relativity.
So here we are at the end of the interview, and I kind of feel the same way that I felt at the end of the book. It so seems like there's something here, but I just can't figure out what it is. And maybe we'll never know, but I just want to tell everybody how awesome this book is once again. It's called A Trojan Feast, Joshua Cutchin, The Food and Drink Offerings of Aliens, Fairies, and Sasquatch. And I was up on Amazon, I think yesterday, and they were absolutely completely sold out. They currently have 4 left. But of course, if you've got a Kindle or any sort of reading device, they're never going to sell out of Kindle versions, obviously. So you can always grab that one. But before we go, let's talk a little bit about what you're planning to do. You mentioned that you're going full time here into your writing career and doing some music. And you mentioned some fiction. Are there any other follow-ups to this book you've been thinking about or anything else in this sort of genre that's coming
up? Absolutely. You know, I I realized that with me taking this career path, I'm going to have to hustle quite a bit. So I actually have a follow-up book in the works that I'm working on. It's not looking at food. It's looking at another one of these aspects of the phenomena that we haven't really given enough attention to, I think. That isn't to say that I don't want to return to the subject of food, because as I mentioned, I feel like there's still a lot there to be looked at. But right now, I'm going to take a break because I've been talking about entity food for a long time. But that's definitely a plan. And I have some other projects in multiple stages of development with some other personalities that I think a lot of in this field. So all a little bit too tentative to really talk about right now, but hopefully I'll be having a lot more conversations with kind folks like you in the future.
I very much hope we can have you back on, because I could have talked about this for 10 years, but I don't want to waste all your time here. But listen, let's get some information about if you've got any sort of social media, website, obviously the book, we can talk about that. Whatever you've got, the floor is yours.
Yeah, well, my website is joshuacutchin.com. I've started blogging there on a fairly regular basis. Trying to take a look at some other little ideas that I have that aren't quite enough to flesh out in a full book. But from there, you can find out news about upcoming projects of mine, be they musical, fiction, or nonfiction. So that's pretty much the hub for everything that I'm doing these days.
JoshuaCutchin.com is the place to go, and please check out Amazon.com, A Trojan Feast, the food and drink offerings of aliens, fairies, and Sasquatch. And in fact, if you want to support this show, you can use the Amazon links that are up at AfterDarkRadioShow.com, and we'll get a small percentage of that sale. But once again, A Trojan Feast, the food and drink offerings of aliens, fairies, and Sasquatch. Joshua Cutchin is our guest. And Josh, I want to thank you so much for doing the show today. Best of luck with the new career, and happy hustling.
Thanks so much. You've been a pleasure to talk to.
And of course, we'll be back in just a moment with more After Dark Radio here on the Dark Matter Digital Network. We are back here on After Dark Radio. Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Broadcasting Network. Here now every Sunday night, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern. If you are listening on a replay, now you know when to listen live, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern, every single Sunday night. This is what will be Art Bell's time slot Monday through Friday, starting in late July. And for more information on that, you can head up right now to artbell.com or the new subscription website, darkmatterdigitalnetwork.com. You can subscribe for $5 a month and be a time traveler. And what that means is you will get full access to all of the Art Bell shows after they air the next morning, all ready to go for you to listen to if you can't stay up late in the evenings to listen to Art Bell live. The show will be free Monday through Friday, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern. The Art Bell Show is free on the Dark Matter Digital Network. If you've got the TuneIn Radio app, for example, you can listen anytime you want, absolutely free, as long as you're listening live. If you want the podcast, if you want the replays, you have to pay as a time traveler. $5 a month. You can sign up now. Hundreds of signups this weekend over there at darkmatterdigitalnetwork.com. So check that out. We got about 15 minutes left in the show. The phone lines are open if you want to give us a call. West of the Rockies, 425-488-0525. East of the Rockies, 425-482-1686. Parts unknown line, anywhere in the world, you can call this line, 425-398-7353. If you're a first-time caller, 425-398-7289. All of these numbers, if you missed them, are available at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. Head up there and check it out, AfterDarkRadioShow.com. Hopefully everybody's enjoying the show tonight. I love the interview that we just finished, A Trojan Feast, the food and drink offerings of aliens, fairies, and Sasquatch is the name of Joshua Cutchin's book. And a replay of this show is going to be available at AfterDarkRadioShow.com if you missed any of that. And if you want to hear the first 30 minutes of this program, when I was in an absolute frazzle, I cannot tell you how many radio shows I have done in my lifetime. And 99 times out of 100, it's no problem. It's a breeze. But I do remember, for example, the first time that I went live all by myself on Wrestling Observer Live, total frazzle. I remember the first time I went live on After Dark Radio when the Dark Matter Radio Network started up. I had been doing After Dark as a podcast for listeners at WrestlingObserver.com, and Dark Matter started up, and I got in touch with Keith and offered the show, and we got to talking about going live. And of course, the very first time that I went live, a complete frazzle. And then tonight, I honest to God didn't think I was going to be in a complete frazzle, but we had a technological hiccup literally 3 minutes before the show was scheduled to go on the air, and I was in a complete frazzle. And I had to change my shirt during the interview, just drenched in sweat. But hey, I feel much better now, and we got 15 minutes left, so let's make the most of it. On the first time, oh man, that person just hung up. First time caller line. Whoever you were, feel free to call back. The way this show works, everybody, if you listen to the old Art Bell show, I got four lines here, all of which are up at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. Dial the number that corresponds to you. It's going to ring and ring and ring and ring. And as soon as you hear the show, you are next in line. So just hang out, and when I throw to whatever your line is, you will be live on the air. If you call and it's busy, if you call and nobody picks up, just keep trying, and eventually you are going to get through. Are you aware that in 9 days now, we could have another Y2K? That's what they claim. Will the leap second on June 30th break the internet, they ask. Experts fear added time could cause computer chaos. This from the Daily Mail. Always fun stuff here in the Daily Mail. On June 30th, at 11:59:59, the world's clocks will add an extra second. This is to account for discrepancy between Earth time and atomic time. But experts warn it could wreak havoc to systems powering the internet. It may cause some systems to crash, while others will be a half second off. It says here on June 30th, these clocks are going to add this extra time. And according to some computer experts, added time could wreak havoc to systems powering the internet. Does this sound familiar? In some systems, it says, the computer clock shows 60 seconds instead of rolling over the next minute or showing the 59th second twice. It says here, as a result, the computer sees a leap second as time going backward, causing a system error in the CPU to overload. For computers that don't crash, processes based on precise timing, such as the amount of time a valve opens to add a chemical to a mix, maybe off by half a second, remains to be seen whether this will create large-scale problems, as some computer scientists have predicted. Do you remember the Y2K scare, some of you that might be a little bit older, when there was great concern that the world doom was coming to the world when the new century rolled over? And at the end of the day, absolutely nothing happened. A couple of things about this story. Number one, for those people mocking this story, because all of the people worried about Y2K and then nothing ended up happening, reality of the situation is some stuff did happen when the calendar rolled over for Y2K. However, if you recall, for years leading up to the year 2000, there were people working to solve whatever problem might be taking place on their end. And perhaps if those people hadn't gone to all the trouble to make sure their systems were all ready to go, Y2K might in fact have caused wide-scale problems. A lot of work was put into making sure Y2K didn't happen. That's number one. Now, on the other hand, it says here that this will be the 26th time since 1972 that a leap second will have been added. So my guess would be, if this has happened 26 times previously, my guess is that most likely the world is not going to be plunged into darkness on June 30th when we have another rollover. But hey, who knows? I guess just keep an eye on all of your systems. To the west of the Rockies line, you're on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
My name is Kevin. I'm calling from Colorado Springs. Can you hear me okay?
I hear you fine, Kevin. What's going on?
Great. I just wanted to tell you, I'm a new listener. I just found out about Art's show, the new show, and sorry, I didn't expect you to answer so quickly. I just, first of all, like I said, that was a great interview.
Oh, thank you.
I'm excited to know that you're the guy that did the Wrestling Observer. I used to be a big-time wrestling fan, and so I'm familiar with your work with that. And I just wanted to call in and say I'm a new listener. I'm glad I found you guys, and I am excited as heck about Art's show. And that's about all I got to say. I just really liked that interview you did tonight, and I'm glad I found it.
Well, so, thank you. Are you? I presume you listened to Art Bell all through the 90s.
Yeah, well, the late 90s. I was I'm blind now, but back then I was an EMT, and I caught him a few times when I was working the midnight shift. And then when I became blind, being a night owl to begin with, I started listening to him on Coast to Coast. And ever since then, I've listened to him, and so I'll refrain from any negative comments toward the other show, but I am very excited to see Art back, because that is the way paranormal radio should be, and your show tonight was an example of that. So props to you, because it's something I've been missing lately. I don't believe in everything that I hear on paranormal radio, but I enjoy it when it's done right, and you and Art do it right. So thank you very much. Oh, and I wanted to tell you my Y2K story.
Okay.
I was at a church service. There was about 15 of us there that night, and exactly at midnight, the power went out for about 15 seconds. We all looked at each other like, what's getting ready to happen? And then the power came back on.
Do you presume it was just a wild coincidence?
So they told us. You wonder, because, you know, that was a little too coincidental for my taste. I won't say I was scared, but I was kind of wondering. So, you know, it was something I won't forget, because the hysteria around Y2K, that my church didn't buy into it. I'm not really religious now, but back then our pastor was poo-pooed all the fear-mongering and that. Obviously, there was a little bit of truth to it, because if you were a thinking person, you realized that when the net was invented, they didn't think about the change of the turn of the century. They just didn't think about it.
Sure.
So had there not been a lot of work done for that change, I think we would have seen something happen. Fortunately, there were some forward-thinking people that got on it to pretty much take away all the bad things that they said was going to happen. But I will not forget that when the power went out and you just stared at the person beside you and said, uh-oh, and then the power comes back on and everything's okay. So anyway.
Well, listen, yeah, I want to thank you so much for the call tonight, and I really do appreciate the kind words. And yes, Art will be back soon, and please continue listening here to this show as well as Art's show as well. I do remember when Y2K occurred. I was at my buddy's house. We had just kind of a little get-together there for the turn of the century, and I didn't think anything was going to happen, and he didn't think anything was going to happen, and no one else thought anything was going to happen. But as it was clicking down, I was like, here it comes. Let's see what happens. And we waited and we waited, and the clock passed midnight and nothing happened. We didn't even get a 15-second power outage. So it ended up being a pretty big disappointment, but I prefer a disappointment than the world being plunged into darkness. And with that, everybody, we got to plunge into darkness here on this program. We got to wrap it up. I want to thank you all so much for listening here tonight. Don't forget, every single Sunday, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern, get into the habit of listening at 9 o'clock, as Art's coming back at 9, starting in late July. Check out artbell.com and everything else, Dark Matter Radio Network, a lot of great shows. I am completely out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. Back next week with more After Dark Radio here on the Dark Matter Digital Network.